Tonight's talk is on the five hindrances and specifically on sensual desire. And I'll give an introduction to the five hindrances. And then for the next 5 weeks, there'll be one of the hindrances will be talked about each week. And at the beginning of the sit, I ask people to do sort of like a check-in, an emotional and physical check-in. And I'd like you right now to do another check-in and just sort of see emotionally, physically, mentally where you are, and specifically if you've noticed any changes. How many have noticed positive changes from sitting? Okay, how many have noticed negative changes from sitting? Okay, how many have noticed neither positive nor negative? Okay. I've noticed the positive. And, you know, with sensual desire, you know, there are good sensual desires. And when we sit, there's actually a very positive emotional hit that we get from meditating. It's one of the hooks for people to continue to meditate because there's an attraction. And so when we talk about sensual desires, you know, there are good and bad. There are skillful and unskillful sensual desires. But first, I want to give like an overview of the hindrances. And, you know, as I was thinking about this talk, I decided to do the overview with a mini meditation on me practicing breath meditation. And I'm going to incorporate the hindrances in sort of like this little dialogue. So as I sit, I'll be sitting and I'll be concentrated and I'll be focused, and then, you know, my leg will start to hurt and, you know, my butt will feel a little uncomfortable. And it's like, you know, if I had a back jack, I'd be really comfortable. And then I could stay more focused. And then my mind goes, desire, return to the breath. So I return to the breath. And then I hear a car drive by, and it's like, and music blaring. It's like they're breaking my concentration. I can't believe these people are so inconsiderate. Ill will. Return to the breath. And I return to the breath. And a few moments later, sometimes, all of a sudden, it's like, you know, that meal I had, that was a really nice meal. And, oh, I'm sort of tired. And then 15 minutes will go by, and it's like, oh, sloth and torpor. Okay. And then, you know, I put my energy up, and then I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden it's like, huh, did I lock my car? I should go out and lock my car. Oh, you know, if I get up, then people will think that, you know, I'm a bad Buddhist because I'm not focused. Oh, and I can't do that. It's like, is my tea okay? You know, if my tea's starting to cool, it's like, did I put the lid on that? It's like, oh, you know, I need to go to the bathroom. I need to do that now. And then it's like, oh, restlessness, you know, worry. And then I could sit for a little bit longer and, you know, this is really stupid. Why am I sitting here? You know, this isn't going to do anything for me. And that's doubt. And so those are the five hindrances in my breathing, and those are all things that have popped through my head on one occasion or another. A traditional view of the hindrances is the first hindrance, sensual desire, sort of like if you have a pot of water and you add colored dye to it, red, blue, green, and then you try and look into it. And what you see, you can't really see your reflection. You'll see it tainted by either the red or the blue or the green dye. And that is how we see things. And one of the lines that I really like is, When one's mind is possessed by sensual desire, overpowered by sensual desire, one cannot properly see the escape from sensual desire which has arisen. Then one does not properly understand and see one's own welfare, nor the welfare of another, nor the welfare of both. And when we get caught in these desires, we suddenly are not able to see clearly. And we don't see our own desire, our own goodness, or our own welfare, our own goodness, or the welfare of others, or the welfare of both ours and theirs. We get distracted. We get pulled outside of our center. With ill will is like a bowl of water that's boiling. And as you try and look into it, outside of getting singed from looking in, it's very hard to see your reflection. With sloth and torpor, it is a bowl of water that sort of like has moss. It's, you know, moss and algae growing. It's very still. It's very thick. And, you know, it's impossible to see your own reflection. It's impossible to see your true nature. With restlessness and worry, it's that bowl of water with winds rolling across it, rippling the water. And it makes it very difficult. You know, you see yourself in a very wavy type way. And with doubt, what is doubt? Oh, it's stirred up and very muddy. So it's sort of like this muddy liquid that as you look into it, it's again very hard to see your own reflection, your own welfare, your own others' welfares, you know, the welfare of both yourselves or others. And what I like about that teaching is that it's a very inclusive one. It includes myself as when I get caught by the hindrances, I can't truly see myself. It means that I can't truly see you, and I can't see us together. And the heart of Vipassana is to be able to see clearly, and to see that all things have suffering, that they're impermanent, and that there is no self. And so that's my introduction for the five hindrances. And when I started looking and preparing for this talk, we actually designated who was going to do each talk maybe a little over a month ago. And when I got sensual desire, I was sort of disappointed because, you know, there were other areas that I thought it's like, well, if I'm focusing on sloth and torpor because that's where I think I should be focusing on, or that's where I wanted to focus on. And with sensual desire, it's, you know, it's big. You know, sensual desire is really big. And as I started looking at it, I realized that, you know, pretty much all the hindrances, they sort of weave into each other. And that, you know, depending on my day, hour, whatever my mood is, you know, one of those hindrances is going to be popping up. And one of my goals is just to be aware of it, to note that this is what's coming up, and to do it without judgment. It's like everyone in this room, you know, the hindrances are alive and well. And, you know, for me, they'll be alive and well for many, many years to come. But one of the things that I want to do is cultivate an awareness of them. Because when I can actually see that I have a hindrance attack, then I actually have some choice and some control. I can sit there, there are antidotes to it. I can either get caught in it or I can try and change it. But if I'm not seeing it, if I'm living in ignorance around that, then I'll just continue doing that. And that will allow me to continue suffering. One of the tests that I wanted to do initially was I decided that I was not going to eat an evening meal for a week before the, actually it was 2 weeks before this talk, and I was just going to sit there and track how I wasn't going to eat this meal and what arose from that. And it's something I've done in the past. You know, when I go on retreat, I usually don't eat an evening meal. So it's, I'm familiar with it and I'm comfortable with it. So I had set a date in my mind to do that. And the date came and I noticed that it's like, you know, I can start this tomorrow. And so I decided I'd start that tomorrow, and then tomorrow came. And then I noticed it's like, you know, maybe the next day is like, you know, I can do this in a different time. And I noticed a week passed, and I kept procrastinating. And then I started getting really frustrated. It's like, oh, you know, I'm going to give a lousy talk. I'm not preparing the way I should be preparing for this. You know, I can't even go one evening without a meal. It's like, what's up with that? Bad Buddhist. And then I noticed, you know, ill will. I noticed remorse. And then I decided to flip it around. It's like one of the nice things about Buddhist practice is I think that there are 84,000 teachings on how to meditate and be mindful. So there's this wealth of stuff. And if I'm stuck in one area, then I can fight my way through it, which is probably not the middle way, or I can sit there and it's like, okay, well, what works? What works at this time in this space for me? And so I decided to sit there and not be an aesthetic, but look, and it's like, okay, what does enjoyment of sensual desire really mean? It's like, I'm afraid of this. And I started asking myself, why? Why am I afraid of this? You know, why am I afraid of committing even to something that simple? And then I just sort of accepted. It's like, okay, well, you know, I will, you know, I won't forego my evening meal, but I will be really aware of what I need, of what I want and why do I want it. And, you know, I just started asking myself every time I wanted something, why do I want it? You know, what does this give me? A couple things that popped up in my head that I noticed was that there was, you know, if I felt lonely, you know, eating was a good cure for that. Going out, talking to people was a good cure for it. It's like I would use the sensual desires, and the sensual desires are the six sense doors. So it's taste, sight, thought, feelings, taste, sight, hearing, and taste, smell. Thank you. And it's sight, smell, hearing, taste, and touch, and consciousness. And the five main ones are all the known body parts. You know, I and I consciousness, smell and smell consciousness, and taste consciousness, body and body consciousness, and whichever one I missed also. And so as I looked at it, you know, what I noticed was that there was this hunger of like, I want this, I want that. And what struck me was I was reinforcing my ego identity, myself. It's like every time I went, it's like, I want. I was solidifying this self of mine. And it was really interesting. You know, I got to sort of look and just understand, it's like, whenever I have desires, it's like I'm solidifying this image of who I am. And in many ways, it's like my desires make up a part of who Bill Hart is. And sometimes I don't like that. Sometimes it's okay. But it was just nice to be able to be aware. It's like, okay, I am molding my image or my image of myself. And so I spent the last like 4 days just exploring that. What I started to look at is like, you know, what does sensual desire really give me? You know, does it give me satisfaction? Does it give me something, a happiness that is really lasting or permanent? You know, when I would eat something, what I noticed is I would have a craving for something. It's like, okay, I'm going to have ice cream. And, you know, and I would go towards having ice cream, and it's like, oh, well, it's, you know, it's cool, it's sweet, it's, you know, I like the consistency. And many of the times when I would be eating the ice cream, it's like I would take my bite of ice cream, and then I would be, you know, preparing, you know, taking my next bite of ice cream. And I wasn't tasting the first bite. I wasn't sitting there mindfully going, okay, one bite, you scoop it in, you know, taste the coolness, taste the consistency, taste the sweetness. You know, I was taking in the second bite and the third bite. And then I was walking down the street. I was doing five or six different things while I'm eating this ice cream that I had a craving for and that I really wanted. And I wasn't fully enjoying it. You know, I was doing something else. And most of the desire or most of the cravings that I had, it's like I was always doing something else along with it. You know, I wasn't staying focused on one thing. And I've been looking a lot at how I multitask these days. And we live in a society where multitasking is, you know, a pretty big thing. And it breaks up my concentration. It breaks up my mindfulness. You know, it pulls my focus outside of my body into something else. And into something else, and it sort of scatters my energy. And when I focus just on one thing, you know, I actually become much more calmer and much more clearer and much more focused. And here, even as we're sitting here, it's like I encourage you all to be focused in your own body right now. It's like the meditation was sort of a prelude to, you know, I divide meditation up into my formal practice and informal practice. And my formal practice is when I sit and I focus on the breath. And in my informal practice, if I'm sitting, I sit and focus on my breath, but I leave about 10 or 15% of my attention to listen to whatever, you know, if it's a Dharma talk, to listen to the Dharma talk. But I encourage you to try and keep your attention in your own body. And at times, it's like, you know, do a check-in. You know, how are you feeling right now? You know, where is your mind and where is your attention? And just be with that. And throughout the whole talk, you know, your mind will wander off. You'll hear a car. You won't like what I say. You'll like what I say. Your attention will get pulled out of your body. And always try and just bring it back in. You know, take a deep breath and just settle into your belly. And let that be the practice. It's like being aware of the body and just the body. When I look at sensual desire, the majority of desires pull me out of my body. And that's where in the Buddhist teachings is there's a strong encouragement to stay focused and stay centered. And the hindrances are hindrances to staying concentrated and staying focused. And that's when we can't see well. We can't see clearly. There are a couple, and I like these. There are a couple of, you know, techniques for conquering the hindrances or minimizing their power. And one of the ones that I like, and you know, it's been a teaching that I've read several times, and I didn't realize that I actually started incorporating it into my reflection on my avoidance of, or my procrastination when I was avoiding not eating my evening meal. But there is a teaching to what the Buddha gave to his son about how to do wise action, wise speech. He goes, when you're doing a wise action, or when you're doing action, it's important that before you do the action, you reflect on whether it will lead to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or to both, or whether it would be of unskillful bodily action with painful consequences and painful results. And if the action is going to cause painful consequences or painful results, don't do it. Now it's a lot easier if I reflect on it before I do something. It's pretty easy if I see the painful action, painful results, not to do it. But the Buddha also said, it's like there's two other times to do that. When you're in the middle of the action, reflect, is this going to cause painful consequences or painful results? And when I'm in the middle of something, actually it's really hard for me to ask that question. You know, if I'm caught up in a sensual desire, it's really hard to ask that question because I don't want to know the answer. And I noticed, you know, during my week of exploring sensual desires, it's like there were many times I did not want to ask those questions. I prefer ignorance at times to freedom from suffering. And, you know, the painful consequences, I didn't have any outlandish painful consequences at all, but I had very subtle ones. You know, the choice to do one action versus another action changes things. You know, if I stay up really late watching, actually I don't have a TV, and in one of my workplaces when I'm off work, they have a TV, and I was watching the news. And I had all the information I needed for me to respond to the world situation. But I continued to watch the news, and I just watched myself get angry and get frustrated. And then I turned off the TV and I went to bed. And I was angry and I was frustrated and I couldn't go to bed. You know, it was hard for me to sleep. And so I tossed and turned, and then the next day I woke up and I was pretty tired because I had tossed and turned. And that was a simple way of, like, you know, all I needed to do was turn off the TV or not even watch the TV. And then a different outcome would have happened. It's like I would have, you know, read something that would have probably put me to sleep. A Dharma book, maybe. I would have woken up in a much more refreshed mode. And I would have been much more alert. And so I noticed that, you know, just these simple choices that I take, those are really where the Dharma for me has richness, is being aware of the little things. The big things aren't big issues for me now. It's like I don't go around screaming and yelling at people, so I don't have to worry about that. But what I do is I turn off my mind in very simple ways. It's like, oh, this won't matter. This won't matter. This ice cream really, you know, it doesn't matter. I remember several years ago, I was gaining weight and I couldn't figure out why I was gaining weight. I really, you know, I was baffled. And I remember sitting at Johnny Rockets at about 11:30 at night, and I was eating chili cheese fries. And I realized that I had been eating chili cheese fries 3 to 4 times a week. And it's like, what's up with that? But I had not even acknowledged. It's like, oh, I'll just go up there and get some, you know, get a bite. And it's like, oh, I have a craving and an addiction. What is that about? And that's one of the keys, you know, when I reflect, what is that about? And, you know, I get amazing answers. You know, sometimes I'm uncomfortable just being with myself. So I go out for whatever. Sometimes I am, you know, I'm trying to avoid procrastination. That's came up a lot, especially this week. I noticed, oh, you know, I don't want to do laundry, you know. So let me go do this instead. And it usually had something to do. Ice cream's was a very interesting support this week for me. But then I would go out and I would go eat Doritos. And it's like, you know, it's not one of my favorite foods. And if I sit there and I eat a Dorito mindfully, it's like, I really don't like it. But that won't stop me from wanting and craving to have a Dorito. And I find that rather humorous in a sad way. You know, I remember just two nights ago, it's like at 9 o'clock, and I don't eat, you know, usually I'll have my dinner around 6 o'clock, and then I don't eat afterwards, for the most part. And, you know, I was taking a break from work, and it's like, I had this craving, it's like, oh, you know, I'm walking outside, and it's like, oh, I should just go to the store and get a bag of Doritos. And, you know, I said no. You know, it was a very simple no. And that was one of the practices of stepping away from the desire and the craving. It's like the several ways that we can remove ourselves from the craving. And one is a simple no. And what I also noticed is that the no has a lot more power when I've done a couple things before. And I came across one teaching where it gave five reasons or it's called the removal of distracting thoughts. And I love the language of a lot of the suttas. You know, there's a very strong there's power to it. And in the suttas, it was primarily directed towards monks and monastics. So there's a very strong language, especially around desire, because the monks had given up all sexual desires. They'd taken a vow of celibacy. So when the Buddha talked about that, you know, he was really, really strong about squelching that, because it creates a whole lot of troubles if your monks and nuns are running around doing, you know, having sex when they've said they're not going to. But some of his five tools for removing distracting thoughts is like, when evil, unskillful thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion arise in the bhikkhu, he should reflect on a different object which is connected with skill. And if that doesn't work, he should ponder on the disadvantages of unskillful thoughts. In this way, truly these thoughts of mine are unskillful and productive of misery. And if that doesn't work, he should, in regard to them, endeavor to be without attention or reflection. And if that doesn't work, then he should reflect on the removal of the thought source. And finally, if that doesn't work, he should, with clenched teeth and tongue pressing on the palate, restrain, subdue, and beat down the evil mind by the good mind. And I love that last one because it never works for me. And what I've realized and what helped me was like when I said no to the Doritos at night, and I was able to do that was because I had done all those other steps first. You know, I had thought about in various ways, but I had reflected on, why am I eating this? You know, is this productive? What is the benefit for this? So I had explored that desire and craving. And when I was able to say no, I had already built this platform. So it was like, this is stupid behavior. This is not... stupid's a bad word. This is not behavior that I want to embrace. And I had the reasoning and logic behind it. And when I've done it before, I haven't had that. So I would sit there and go, no, I'm not going to do this. And my whole body and mind would resist. It's like, no, why am I giving up? I'll be deprived. I'll be unhappy. I'll be this. I'll be that. And there's this fear comes up. And when I am able to sit there and contemplate, the fear doesn't arise. And a choice arises, like, do I want this or do I want that? There's a teaching that has supported me a lot in this is forsake the lesser pleasure for the greater pleasure. And the lesser pleasure is all the stuff that I think I want and I need, the instant gratification, the cravings, the addictions, and all this stuff. And the greater pleasure is a contentment, a wisdom, an awareness, an ability to see things as they are. And, you know, I'm a long way from seeing things as they truly are. But through the teachings, I have an idea of what that is. You know, through meditation, practice, and sitting, I have an idea of what that is. And that inspires me to keep going. I have, at times, a serenity that I really love and enjoy. And it is cultivated by mindful action. It's cultivated by being patient. It's not cultivated by feeding my instant gratification or needing those instant gratifications. It never has been. You know, yeah, it never has been. Though I still reach out for that instant, oh, this will make me feel better for this moment. But in the long term, you know, they haven't brought me long-term satisfaction. And there's a difference. You know, forsake the lesser pleasure for the greater. And I use that, it's like, when I want something and I notice that I'm feeling deprived, you know, forsake the lesser pleasure. Because I've got a better deal happening. And when I do that, when I forsake the lesser pleasure, you know, there's so many benefits from that. You know, the first is I'm developing patience, you know, which, you know, I can always use a lot more of. Another thing, I'm developing compassion. Because when I'm caught up in that desire, I know we're all caught up in desires of one form or another. You know, we're all in the same boat. So when I see someone acting out, it's like, that's me acting out also. You know, and if I can change my behavior slightly, you know, that makes things just a little bit better all the way around. It's sort of like, am I, you know, with the reading I said before, am I able to see my own good or my own welfare? Or the welfare of others, or the welfare of myself and others. Am I able to cultivate that? And when I'm caught in desires, I can't. But when I'm not caught in it, I can. I can get glimpses of that. Some of the other techniques, there are six formal ways of removing craving for sensual desire. And the first two are fun ones. And it's about looking at the body. Especially and this is, you know, again, very much for monks, but you guys are free to go out and try it. And it's called the cemetery meditation, where we go where someone has died and then just sort of watch the body decay. And then what you see from that is impermanence. And you see that the beautiful form that we imagine can actually look pretty ugly. And so there's a sense of repulsion from that. You know, it's actually, yeah, odds are none of us are going to do that in this country. One of the ones I like is guarding the sense doors. And, you know, that's how that's done is one of the techniques is called noting. So when I have a craving for, since my theme is ice cream tonight, it's like, okay, ice cream. It's like, oh, note, craving. When I have a craving for, you know, food, or personal relationships, or whatever it is, I own it. You know, it's like, oh, I have a desire for this. I have a craving for that. And by noting it, by owning it, you know, I'm seeing the desire. I'm seeing the craving. And it's done in a compassionate way. I'm not judging myself. It's like, I'm not saying, oh, I'm bad because I like this, or I'm bad because I want that. It's more like, oh, this is what I want. And then once I have acknowledged what I want, then I can do my reflection. Why do I want it? You know, what benefit will this bring? Will this cause suffering to myself or to other people? Will it benefit myself and other people? You know, and then I ask the questions. And, you know, sometimes I'll do the wise thing. Sometimes I'll do the unwise thing. And then I can reflect on that. You know, and it's a process of reflection. It's a process of awareness. And through that awareness, change comes. You know, when I try and sledgehammer a behavior of myself, it just doesn't work. But when I sit there and go, why am I doing this? And sometimes I ask that, you know, I'm still asking the question on some behaviors. And they'll change. You know, as long as I'm honest with myself and I own it, they'll change. And they'll change, you know, I've built up this layer of habit. And habit is a really hard thing to break. And once I start owning a behavior, you know, the habit gets exposed for what it is. There's a story I heard, I think this is a Zen story, of a monk who was, you know, he was a master and he was sitting and focusing, and he had a cat that, you know, used to hunt rats in the place, but whenever the monk was meditating would sit on the monk's lap, and the monk was, you know, solid and wouldn't move at all. And the monk died, and his students sort of looked around and said, well, you know, he reached enlightenment and there was a cat on his lap. So they would go and they would get cats and sit on, you know, for the cat to sit on his lap. And you know, over the years and centuries, it's like all of a sudden it was, you know, you needed to have a cat sitting on your lap for you to reach enlightenment. And nobody questioned why. You know, and just to give you a clue, it's like you really don't need a cat to reach enlightenment. If you do have a cat, it can help, but if you don't, it's not required. And that also sort of goes into, it's like when we build up a tradition of some sort, it's like we need to be aware that that tradition may not be applicable at this point. You know, our habits, you know, inquiry helps us look at our habits, and it's like, is it a wise habit? Or is it something that we do just because we've been doing it for 15 years and we don't know any better? So that's where the noting comes in. It's like, oh, I know, I see this behavior. In meditation retreats, it's like, we move really slowly and everything we do is mindful. So I'll be sitting there, and before I started sitting, if I had an itch, it's like, okay, go itch it. And then, you know, after I started sitting, I'd have an itch, and it's like, oh, itch, itch, discomfort, oh, tingling. And then I'd explore the itch. And then sometimes I'd scratch it. But most times, you know, as I started to explore it, I became really curious. And I was amazed. It's like how many things I just do automatically. And so as we note, we stop that automatic stuff. And with the cravings and with the sensual desires, we can actually break it because we're acknowledging it. And it's like, oh, it's no longer habit. Another one is moderation in eating, you know, especially around the sense door of taste. You know, why do we eat? What are we eating? Be curious about it. Is it healthy? Is it, you know, does it benefit others? You know, I struggle around, you know, both actually, you know, meats in general. You know, fish, meat, chicken, it's like, you know, what is it that I'm promoting if I eat meat? If I eat farm-raised fish, do they have pesticides? You know, what is it that's actually, you know, there's this whole, this piece of, let's say, a steak. You know, there's a whole industry that lives behind this steak. And is it something that I want to support? A lot of animals are just, you know, they're treated horrendously. It's like, is that what I want to eat? You know, so if it's not, then what are my alternatives? And then I look at what those alternatives are. But if I don't note, oh, if I don't ask the question, I don't know. And I won't, you know, I won't change anything. And that ignorance on my part of not asking the question supports huge industries. And so again, it's just, you know, cultivating awareness without judgment. And that's to me is one of the foundations of Buddhism, is the compassion that when we do when we inquire, when we look into ourselves, when we sit, we do it with love and compassion. We are cultivating an awareness of ourselves. We are not here to beat ourselves up. We're good people. And sitting here, it's like, when I first sat, it's like, oh, I'm sitting. I'm doing this perfectly. And it's the first time I've ever, it's like, you know, my first retreat, I'm doing it perfectly. I had no clue what I was doing, but I was doing it perfectly because I had the intention to meditate. I had the intention to still my mind. And, you know, I was 2 days behind all the instructions and it still didn't matter. It's like, I'm doing this perfectly. And it was such a nice feeling. And when we sit here, we're doing it perfectly because the mindfulness is, for me, my mind wanders. Oh, wandering mind. The minute I notice that my mind's wandering, that's when I'm on point. That's when I'm aware. And that's the good point. That's the good time. That's not the time to beat myself up going, oh, I can't believe, you know, I've been asleep for 15 minutes. No, I've been awake for 1 second. And that's good. You know, that's the start of the practice, is we build up, we create new habits. And we cultivate them in the small little things we do, the small awarenesses. Another of the six ways conductive to abandonment of sensual desire is noble friendship. And noble friendship is, it's the community here, and it's also the people that we surround ourselves with who we can talk about issues that normally we don't talk about. For me, I have a small little sitting group where, you know, it's all very good friends. And we've been sitting for actually a while, and, you know, we'll sit for a little bit. And then everybody goes round robin and shares about what's going on, what's happened for them in that week. And it's really powerful. It's like, especially when people are struggling and they share about that, or when I'm struggling and I share about that, I've created an environment where I have a safe place to talk about the things that are going on in my life, where looking good means being honest, and talking about the things that I am messing up on. You know, not doing the way I would like, where I'm stumbling. And having that safe place creates a really powerful environment. And when I hear other people share, I get inspired. And so I see noble friendship as people in your life who inspire you. And then being around those people. And there are people, you know, in my life and your life that, you know, I won't go there. I was going to say, it's like, you know, there are people that, you know, don't inspire me. And it's like, how can I cultivate a relationship with them that is inspiring, that is supportive for both of us? And I think you know, I think it takes both, you know, people who I'm inspired by and maybe people who can be inspired by me, that, you know, that blending, you know, so I am looking up for seeing the welfare, the good in me, seeing the welfare, the good in others, and seeing the welfare in both. And that actually takes, you know, that takes both aspects. Those who, you know, my limited view does not, I'm not inspired by them. And it's in part because I have a limited view of them or a fixed view of them. And how can I open up that view to see the person in a different way? You know, suitable conversation is the last of the ways to abandon sensual desire. And that's, I think that's pretty self-explanatory. It's, you know, the suttas talk about trying to avoid coarse speech, harsh speech, and here it's sort of, you know, how do we cultivate wise conversation? How do we cultivate conversations that inspire us? I'm getting on an inspiring kick all of a sudden here. But I sort of see that as the core. It's like, you know, there are conversations that can be titillating, gossip, and what do they really give us? And then there are conversations like, you know, I'm really struggling with this. You know, how have you handled a situation like this? You know, those conversations where I'm seeking advice, you know, those hold richness for me. Or hearing somebody who has talked about a difficulty and how they have dealt with it in a positive way. It's like those are real, you know, I hear those conversations and they get cataloged in my brain somewhere, and I may forget who spoke them, I may forget where I heard it, but if a similar situation comes up, you know, oh, you know, I remember somebody did this to get through this. And it's sort of like when I was being resistant to eating that my evening meal. It's like all of a sudden I started stepping into reflection. It's like, okay, well, what does this mean? You know, as I shifted my perspective. And I didn't remember where those teachings came from, but they were there. And that's where wise speech or where good conversation comes in. It's like we may not remember it, but we're planting seeds that will come to fruition when the time's ripe. And it's by opening up our hearts and putting our direction. It's like, oh, I can spend time gossiping or I can spend time having a rich conversation. You know, which one do I want? You know, forsake the lesser pleasure for the greater pleasure. And on that note, I shall end the talk on sensual desires. So we have about 8 minutes or so if anyone has questions. Please.
I'm delaying the instant gratification for the lesser, for the greater, for the later gratification. Mm-hmm. What if whatever that instant gratification is, whether it is small or big, whatever it is, what keeps you from focusing on the later or the, you know, the delayed gratification is realizing or having so many experiences in life that show you how short life is. Mm-hmm. What if I die the next moment? Mm-hmm. What if I'm going to die tomorrow? That makes it difficult to delay the gratification. What's your... Especially, I mean, like I know in my life I've seen lots and lots of people dying at every age, young and old, mm-hmm. regardless of the age, 20s, 30s. A lot of them, especially if they are young, it's unexpected. Mm-hmm. Whether it is unexpected cancer or accident. Basically, like, there is no guarantee we are going to be here tomorrow mm-hmm. or whenever. So how do you balance that thinking with being able to delay whatever it is that you are craving?
I think none of us are aesthetics here. So, you know, we're always going to be embracing instant gratification in some form. But being able to look is like, does this pleasure truly satisfy me? And that's really the key. A lot of instant gratification, you know, may satisfy for a moment, but then 5 minutes later, I'm hungry again. I want more. It doesn't fully satisfy. So when we forsake the lesser pleasure for the greater pleasure, we're going for a pleasure that is not extinguishable. It's sort of like when, you know, after when you all sat today and at the beginning I asked, you know, how you felt afterwards. You know, did you feel, was the sit pleasurable? No, that wasn't the word that I used. But that type of pleasure, that type of contentment from sitting is a very powerful pleasure. You know, and as we cultivate it, it's a very rich pleasure. It's one that does not depend upon ego. It's one that does not depend upon desire. It's not one that depends upon my mind just went blank for a second. It's from my experience. It's like when you're talking about over a period of time, you know, we learn from our experiences. It's like, what really makes me happy? What really makes me content? And does instant gratification really make me content?
And what if whatever it is that you think will really make you happy is something you are craving but you are not getting?
Get it. See if it makes you happy. You know, experience is one of the foundations of Buddhist practice. It's like, it's through our experience that the teachings get reinforced. It's through my experience that, oh, this behavior doesn't make me happy. And then I look at the teachings and they pretty much say the same thing. So I use the teachings as, you know, they're guides for me. And also, you know, my experience is my foundation for it. It's like, oh, this behavior doesn't make me happy. Not in the long run. Ice cream, you know, bottom line, doesn't really make me happy. I can live without it, no problem at all. Okay.
I just wanted to respond to her question, like, because I've been going through that a lot recently. When I reflect on death and I see how short life is, I want to spend my time meaningfully. So you have to ask yourself, what's more meaningful, having an ice cream or going on a nice walk? And what's more meaningful, having a Snickers bar or joining a tennis ladder and playing tennis every morning? I think the more I reflect on death and the impermanence and how short life is, the more I want to spend it doing really meaningful things. And a lot of the time, things that bring instant gratification aren't that meaningful. You know, things that bring greater satisfaction, gratification, are really meaningful, wholesome things.
You know, one of the keys is like looking at the instant gratification, and when you forego it, you're cultivating, as I said before, we're cultivating patience, and we're also cultivating compassion. You know, so we're, you know, by being holding off on something, we are training our minds. You know, it's sort of like you go to the gym, you exercise, and if you exercise once every year, you know, not a whole lot's going to happen. But if you sit there and you do it on a daily basis, and you know, it's like, okay, what is this giving me? You know, as we sit on a daily basis, there's a slow, gradual change that happens that we may not notice immediately, but there's a slow change. And our perspective shifts because of the small things that we've done. Please.
This has been in my head since I heard the word hindrance. So I have to ask it. What if we were to experience desire not as a hindrance, to allow and see it as a window of opportunity to maybe disengage from it so it doesn't control us, so that the desire has no control over us, but to really allow us to step back, sense it, observe it, and let it be. To change the mindset from it as a hindrance so that it doesn't take control over us. Allow it and attempt to disengage. Step back. Observe, if possible. And look at it as outside of you. And you are the decision maker.
No, I think that's actually a way of practicing. You know, the key is, you know, to be able to step back and not get caught up in it, not get attached to it. And if you can do that, that's great. You know, the reason it's a hindrance is because it's really, really hard to do. And we get attached and we crave. And it's like, I have a desire, and then I want that desire. And once I get that desire, well, I want two of those next time. And then there's this tree of desire that comes up. But if I can sit there and go, oh, desire. Oh, you know, that's nice. It tastes nice. It's sweet. And then I go on my merry way, and I don't crave it anymore. That's perfect. But the problem is, you know, I go back to it. It's like, oh, I like that. I want that. And then I start grasping it. So that's why it's called a hindrance. But if you can sit there and be totally distant, and here's this desire out there, which it is out there, and just go, oh, it's out there, and leave it be, that's great. But we get drawn out of our bodies into that desire. And that's where it becomes a hindrance, because it breaks us from seeing our true selves, from being at peace with ourselves, because we want this. This will make me happy. This will make me content. And on that note, we need to end. And if you have any questions, you feel free to come up and ask me. But our group needs to end. And, you know, as we end, you know, whatever merit that you feel that we've accumulated here or that you've accumulated, you know, if you'd like, offer to other beings, you know, to those people who are not able to be at a meditation center, who are struggling in other countries where there's war, hunger, you know, even in your own families, where if you'd like to offer the merit of what you've done here to them, just offer to them.